Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule, so sometimes if it takes me 2 weeks to read a book, I'll put the podcast up online 2 weeks later. Sometimes, though, like now, I read a book in about a day and a half, so I record the next podcast 2 days later. That's what's happened this time. Like I said, I put the last podcast up online on Friday and now it's Sunday morning and I'm reviewing the next book here. Actually, when I'd finished the podcast last time round, I was already about seven chapters into the current book, which is, let me just pick it up here, Red Thunder by John Varley. And then on Saturday, I got up at like 4:30 in the morning or 5:00 in the morning, and I flew from Berlin to Paris, and then from Paris to Naples, and then I was waiting around in Naples, and then I got on a cruise ship where I work on a cruise ship. I'm a professional juggler, if you haven't listened to other podcasts, and I've talked about that, so I'm doing a show tomorrow night. Anyway, so it gave me plenty of time to finish off this book. And I don't think I've read any of the books by John Varley. I might have done, but the name doesn't immediately jump out at me. But I saw that the book titled Red Thunder recommended on some blogs, on some websites online. I can't actually remember off the top of my head where or which blogs or which websites I saw it recommended, but because I don't have internet access at the moment, but it was certainly like at least two places I think it was recommended. So when I saw it at my local secondhand English bookshop, I thought I'd just decide to pick it up and give it a go. This book is set around about, oh, let me just see when it was written. I think it's written very recently, maybe early, what, 2002, I think. Let me quickly look here. Yeah, 2003 it was written. So it's set probably around about 10 years in the future. And in the world, nothing much has changed, though. Although it has been a bit of an advance in NASA's sort of arena. They've sort of have a new launcher, and they're sending people into space quite regularly. And China also has a successful space program, and they've sent a manned mission to Mars. And this is kickstarts a new space race. And the USA puts together their own manned mission with their own team of seven astronauts and sends it off to Mars as well. NASA knows that they're not actually going to get there first. They're only going to get their second place. But it's all for, like, nationalist pride. All those reasons they decide to go anyway. And like I say, not a lot else has changed in 10 years from now. Except I think there's a female president of the United States. But I think that's just incidental. Nothing much has changed. And I'm undecided, actually, if this is... it could either be a clever decision by John Varley so the world seems really authentic. Or maybe it's just a pure lack of imagination. I'm not entirely sure. So the story is... well, first of all, I guess the category of the story is one that I like to call, this science fiction, it's like to call budget space missions. And these revolve around a team of people who are trying to get into space with limited resources. And they've got to sort of borrow old NASA rockets, and they patch together, you know, different technologies to get into space. And there's some really good examples of this off the top of my head. Quite a few books, I think, by Stephen Baxter follow this kind of thing, like his Manifold series. It's like, oh, we've got to get to Mars, and we've got to do it in... not to Mars, maybe to the Moon, and we've got to do it in a week. And so they've got to put together a space mission in a week or 2 weeks or something. And another good example is that Larry Niven book, or Jerry Pornell book, maybe the two of them wrote it together, The Fallen Angels, and that's another one. There's like, it's set in an encroaching ice age, and they get someone back into space. And there's some others as well. I think Ben Bover's done this kind of thing a few times as well. Lots of other examples too. Again, they're all just off the top of my head. Maybe I'm mistaken in some of the authors there or the titles. I'm not sure. And I normally really like these novels because to me they just read like, okay, here we have someone who's obviously knows very much about space technology. Maybe they've worked for NASA and things like that, because that's what quite a few science fiction authors do. They've worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And they're sort of like frustrated about NASA. And this seems to me like their creed of like, hey, let me take the reins of NASA for a while and on no budget at all, I'll get people into space and we've got it all there. And also, I think they're really quite educational books as well, because they're based so much in the technology that we have at the moment and what is possible based on current technology. So, yeah, this book is a sort of, I would say, fits into that mold but breaks it in some very specific ways, which I'll go into in a bit. So this book opens, and the prologue is pretty much our first-person protagonist called Manny, or Manuel. He's talking to his best friend, and his best friend is called Dak. I can't remember if that's his full name or his shortened name or just a nickname, but Dak, anyway. And they're talking about how they're going to build a spaceship and to go to Mars. And they're just teenagers and kids and stuff. It's very clear like that in the beginning of the book. And they hit upon the idea of using a railroad carriage, like one that carries liquid, sort of like a pressurized liquid railroad carriage container. And they just say, we'll just knock the wheels off and we'll stand it on an end and there is our, you know, pressure container. There's our spaceship that we need to go to Mars. And then it says, but that, I'll just flick to it here. But yes, but that was about a month before it all started. Oh, no, that all came later. It started a month earlier. And so then we have one of those glimpses of the future, and now we catch up situations, which is meant to like heighten the tension in the book and heighten what's going to happen now, what's going to go over in this month's time. Except in this case, it takes 20 chapters to get back to that point in the story. As far as I can tell, I wrote, made a note of this. It was 208 pages into the book. 208 pages into a 410-page book. That's when we get to know what happens after that point. And that's why I actually read 8 chapters in my first sitting, because I was thinking, oh, great, we're going to get into space. Some kids are going to build a spaceship, go to Mars. Great. Because I actually quite like the idea of building spaceships out of railway cars. But it felt like I was never going to get there. It was just like chapter after chapter after chapter. And it just goes on and on and on and on before they ever even start building the spaceship. Actually getting into space happens really, really late in the story. So, and they do get into space. I'm not giving anything away there. It's quite obvious. So the story up until that point, it goes like this. So Manuel and his girlfriend called Kelly and his best friend Dak and Dak's girlfriend Alicia, they're all sort of teenage kids, and they're watching the launch of the NASA Mars mission, which is going, you know, it's going up into space in Florida from Cape Canaveral, and they all live in the area. They all live down there in Florida. And they watch the spaceship go up, and they're like, woohoo, America going to Mars. This is pretty cool. And then they take Dak's pickup truck, and which he actually calls Blue Thunder. It's like, oh, I wonder what the name is going to be of the spaceship when they build it. Maybe Red Thunder? I mean, not a very a cool name for the book. Or not a very like memorable name for the book, in a way. And so we know, you know, they go for a spin on the beach in this pickup truck, and they almost run over and almost kill a drunken ex-astronaut called Travis. And this guy is very drunk, so they take him home. And when they get taken to his home, they run into his cousin, who's this mad inventor called Jubal. And then one thing leads to another, and because Manuel and Dak are both students, or online students, of the Internet University, and they're studying space-related topics because they both want to have a career somewhere in the space industry, they ask Travis, this ex-astronaut, to teach them in their space-related studies. And then another thing leads to another thing, and the mad inventor called Jubal, he invents this force field machine, which makes these perfectly reflective, perfectly spherical containers, very reminiscent of the ones in The Peace War by Werner Vinge, the book I reviewed earlier on this year and rated quite highly. And then one thing leads to another, and they turn that into a rocket driver, and one thing leads to another, and they decide to go and make a spaceship and go to Mars. I'm not really giving anything away here, because, of course, it's a book about going to Mars. But the story, they just go there and they come back, and it's completely forgettable, really, this story. I wouldn't say forgettable, because there's not actually that much to remember about it. It's just really, really bland. There's no tension in the book at all. And there's this thing that happens on the way back from Mars, which is the only time I think it felt like, oh, suddenly we need some drama, we need some tension. Let me put in this disaster into the book. But it's obvious that our heroes are going to save the day, and it's just obvious because it's sort of written into the book. Oh, this is going to happen later in the book, and we're going to save this thing. We're going to use this spaceship in this way. But then again, it's not all John Varley's fault that we know it's all happening, because this incident is actually given away on the back cover of the book. I'm not going to read it. If you pick up this book, don't read the back cover, because it actually spoils something. It's meant to come as a surprise. It's meant to come as this big disaster that happens in chapter 30 of a chapter, like a 32-chapter book. I made a note of this. And it's spoiled within the 7 first words on the blurb on the back of the back cover. So, who are the publishers? Ace Science Fiction. Seriously, get someone else to write the back covers of your book. Don't give away things that happen in the last 3 chapters of your book on the back cover. It's really, really not cool. So, yeah, there are plot elements that are put in place to increase the tension as well. Like, they lose communications with Earth once they're in space. But, you know, after all the preparations, it's like, okay, everything, we've got to take it along 3 times, and we've got to have, like, 3 radios and 3 this and 3 that and everything. We've got to have, like, multiple redundancies. And then how they actually lose communications with Earth is just so implausible. It's just shoehorned in there to give a bit more tension. It's just really, really transparent, if you know what I mean. Transparently just, you know, shoved in there to sort of create tension back on Earth, so the people back on Earth don't know what's going to happen. It's really annoying. So that's the story. I'd give the story 1 out of 5, maybe less than that, I don't know. So onto the characters of the book. Our protagonist, Manny, is pretty much entirely devoid of anything interesting happening in his life. He works and lives in a hotel by the sea down in Florida, and it's just, I'm just not interested to read about that kind of thing. It could have been interesting if he had, like, anything going on in his life, but it doesn't happen. He's completely one-dimensional. And he's got this rich girlfriend, and they have this perfect relationship. And because it's so perfect and they never fight and nothing ever happens, it's just so uninteresting, so boring. Because they're together at the beginning of the book and they don't fall in love. So even though they're in a relationship, there's no, like, love interest. There's nothing dramatic about their relationship. And then there's no ups and downs throughout the book. And at the end, they're still together. And we don't see how they fell in love. And we don't see why they love each other or anything like that. It's just they don't have anything in common. Or maybe they do. I don't know. But they have a good sex life. They mention quite often that they have sex at every opportunity, except when they're really tired. But otherwise, it's just boring. And then there's Dak, who's also completely one-dimensional. And he has his poor girlfriend, who's also one-dimensional, but sort of like the opposite of the rich girlfriend. But they're good friends because they work together at this refuge for drug people and homeless people, drug addicts and homeless people. And they also have this, like, perfect and completely uninteresting one-dimensional relationship. And they're together at the beginning of the book, and there's no ups and downs throughout the book. And at the end, they're still together. And it's just, again, we just don't see anything happening in these relationships. And they're all just teenage kids as well, just who happen to randomly live together and do stuff together and then randomly happen to be in the right place at the right time and get into space. It feels very much like, to me, every time I was reading it, it's like, because they're just kids. Well, I say the kids, maybe 18, 19 years old. I'm not sure exactly what the ages are meant to be. But it just feels like I'm reading like a Famous Five book by Enid Blyton. If you've ever read those, you'll know what I mean. It's like two boys, two girls, and a dog. And every book, they have an interesting, exciting adventure. It just reminds me of that kind of setup, except I think maybe Enid Blyton creates more interesting characters and more interesting adventures for the Famous Five and the Secret Seven and all the other people to go on. The other main characters, I guess two others, is Travis, this ex-astronaut who's a drunkard. And his backstory actually seems quite interesting. Again, it's one of those situations where I'd be more interested to read about his adventures being a NASA pilot and a NASA astronaut than what we actually find here in the book. Because back in the day, he was involved in not just one, but two emergency landings of the new sort of NASA space shuttle that they put together. And he's got these major character flaws that come out in these adventures, but his heroism is just enough so he doesn't get put in jail at the end of this, so it's not too controversial what he does there. But in the book, he stops drinking. It happens at the beginning of the book, I'm not giving anything away, and he becomes nothing more than a very straight-laced, one-dimensional, like, all-American space pilot hero. And it just makes me nod off to sleep every time that he comes on the page. It's just, oh man, he could have been so interesting. And then the second one, his cousin, his mad inventor cousin, which is very much a character study of a retarded genius. That's actually probably how I think it's how it's described in the book, this guy. Because he comes from this southern white trash family, and we're told his backstory in excruciating detail at the start of the book. In fact, of all the characters in the book, the biggest introduction of any character isn't for Jubal, it's for Jubal's father. Who also seems like quite an interesting character, although not that believable, all this situation. But then again, I've never actually lived in the Everglades in Florida, so I'm not entirely sure what the sort of like white trash situation down there is meant to be like. But yeah, it was okay. So we get to know Jubal's brothers and his family as well. More trailer trash, because they also help build the spaceship. But these character introductions, all of them, are just so tedious. Like I said, half the book for them to even start building the spaceship. And in this time, we're treated to like huge passages about how our main characters like live in Florida, and this one works in a garage, and this person works as a nurse, and this person works at a car selling place, and this person works in a hotel. And, you know, they go to Mars, and yet there's pages and pages and pages and pages given over to describing the hotel that the guy lives in. And they get to Mars, and there's like two paragraphs about what it's like to be on Mars, and they go to space and there's like three paragraphs about what it's like to be in space, but pages and pages and pages of what it's like to live in Florida and not have any money. And I just don't care about all of this, you know. I don't care about living in the Everglades or in a trailer park, or you know, and if you do live in the Everglades or in a trailer park, you don't actually have to be a stereotypical white trash kind of sloppy, stupid, like idiot kind of guy. And they're, but they're pimping their cars, and you read about the tragedies in the past life or in the previous lives and stuff. And I got sick of it. In fact, it got to one point. Alicia's father. It's like, what? Where is her father? What are we reading about this? You don't hear about her, and it's set up, and then it starts on the story of her father and of her life at home. And I realised it was just going to be another clunky, pointless story about, oh, I'm really poor, but yet I'm plucky and I'm making the best out of my life, that kind of story. And I've read about 5 or 6 of them in the book already, so I just skipped forward 2 pages. And I don't think I missed very much. So while the book is called Red Thunder, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think it was called Redneck Thunder. So it's just that kind of thing. I say Redneck Thunder. I mean, rednecks have always sort of like portrayed as racist and poor white trash, and as all I know as a British guy living in Germany. But of course, they're not quite that, because one of the main characters, or two of the main characters, are black, and one of them Hispanic and things like that. But it's like, really is like rednecks in space. There are minor characters in the book as well. They're actually more interesting, or more fun to read about. They're certainly not more interesting, but they're more fun to read because they're just as one-dimensional, but we don't actually have to put up with the pages and pages and pages of backstory for each. We're sort of given their actions and given what they say, and we just pick up their characters from that rather than it all being spelled out for us, like page after page. Another thing that makes the characters a bit bland is because they've got nothing to fight against and nobody to fight against. There's no interesting villains in this book. And I think that's actually one of the main failings of the book. They've not actually got all that much to fight for. I say fight for, to do for. They don't have a huge amount of motivation, except maybe it's like, oh, we're plucky poor kids and we want to build a spaceship to go to Mars. That's pretty much all they have. They say James Bond is only such a badass, you know, he's such a good character, you want to see him fight because he fights against the biggest evil dictators and crime bosses in the entire world. You know, when the enemy that you're fighting against is really good, then it's worth reading about the hero. That's why in the histories of Julius Caesar, he always says, you know, oh, well, the Gauls were these fantastic fighters, and we went to Britain, and the Britons were fantastic fighters as well. Even if they weren't, you sort of big up your enemies, and then you seem better. But there's no credible threat in this book at all. There's some FBI agents who, like Travis, just tricks. He just acts drunk and just tricks them into going away again. It's just like, oh, was that meant to add any tension? Because it didn't. And then there's the Chinese political officer when we meet the Chinese in space. Again, really not giving anything away here in this book. And there's this political officer who's, you know, the Stasi, as we call them in East Germany, the Stasi officer who's just there to make sure everyone stays in line. And it's exactly the same character from Encounter with Tiber, that book that I panned a few weeks ago when I read it. And I'm not talking about it's like, oh, it's just influenced by this. It's the same character. He probably even has the same name. He fills exactly the same role. The thing is, in Encounter with Tiber, the political officer from China actually has some impact on the story, and in this book, absolutely no impact on the story whatsoever. And actually, I can see quite a few influences from Encounter with Tiber on this book. Again, like the young heroes, 2 girls, 2 boys, and they go into space and they grow up and they go have these life challenges and they grow up when they go into space. The thing is, if Encounter with Tiber is one of the main influences that I see in the book, I don't see that as a good thing at all if you've read or if you've listened to my review of that book there at all. And also the book, I found it really like jingoistic and overly American patriotic wise, I guess. And it's patronizing, not just patriotic, but patronizing and completely out of touch with other cultures. The portrayal of Russia and China in the book is so shallow. It's almost racist the way that they portray the Chinese in the book here. So I think overall this whole setup, I'm not sure if I'm meant to find it funny or not. You know, rednecks in space, white trailer trash in space. It's like, haha, funny? Is it meant to be? I don't know. The jokes were written on the page, and we're told that the characters found them funny, and they found it was a funny situation. They're laughing all day about it. But I didn't even smile on the inside, let alone crack a smile on the outside. And this actually, again, is a direct contrast to the previous book that I reviewed here just a few days ago, Use of Weapons by Ian M. Banks. That is like a serious, like, literary novel. It's held up to be like a serious literary novel. Yet I was grinning all the way through it. The characters are actually really funny and engaging, and they really jumped off the page to me. And the situations that someone was in, you could see like the irony there. You could see the humour right there. It's self-evident in the situations. In this book, we're told, you know, in John Varley's Red Thunder, we're just told stuff is meant to be funny and the characters are funny, and we just, you know, have to accept them as such. And the quote's on the back of the book, actually really bad here. Check this out. It says, a riveting sci-fi thriller with hilarious, well-drawn characters, extraordinary situations presented plausibly, plus exciting action and adventure by Publishers Weekly, a starred review. And I pretty much disagree with every single point of that little review there, especially the presented plausibly. Let me go a bit into the technology in this book. You know, the whole concept of the book is wrapped up in the prologue that I mentioned earlier. Hey, a railway wagon. Let's build a spaceship out of the pressure container that normally holds milk. And we're going to go into space in one of these things. Great. And then you think, well, okay, John Varley, how are you going to power a spaceship made out of railway wagons into space? And so to power it, we have this, like, random guy who's randomly the cousin of the main astronaut guy, and he randomly invents a device. And I'm not saying randomly, he doesn't even understand what he's done himself, this mad inventor called Jubal, and it can contain, you know, as much energy as you'll ever need it to be. It breaks every single law of thermodynamics, but it's not dangerous in any way, and it happens to be exactly the right size to fit on the bottom of a railway wagon to send it into space. And it's simple enough to build from old video game console controllers. I'm not kidding about this, literally old video game console controllers, and this massive, like, world-changing technology. But then nobody in the book is clever enough to understand how it works, so it's never clearly explained to me or you as the reader. And the person who invented it, Jubal, he has the most amazing brain in the entire planet. You know, as a child, he was told, you know, E equals MC squared. He was told what E means, he was told what M means, he was told what C means. And then within about, like, 5 or 6 seconds, he's not only understood it completely, he's deduced from that the Big Bang, and he's, you know, he's many times more intelligent and brilliant than Einstein and Newton combined, and yet he lives in a shed in Florida, and he's so brain damaged that he can't actually explain how his invention works either to anyone. That's the situation that we have. You know, it's just here. So let me just explain it, because I don't mind that a technology is completely unbelievable, as long as it impacts the world in a plausible and intelligent way. Because, like I said before, Redneck Thunder has these completely, you know, spherical, completely reflective, like, bubbles that appear out of midair. And so did The Peace War by Werner Vinge. But there's parallels there quite striking. And yet there's two different approaches which can't be clearer. So I just really want to break this down now at the end of this podcast about, like, what I really like about science fiction and what I really hate about science fiction. Exhibit A, The Peace War. Werner Vinge posits this revolutionary bubbling technology. And the question is asked, how would this impact the real world? You know, in the first instance it's used, it changes the balance of power in the whole world completely. And there follows this massive upheavals in the political sphere, and there's wars, and there's plagues, and there's nuclear attacks here, and there's, like, massive reductions in the population of the world, and there's a stagnation in technology because, you know, all technology is prohibited in case other people manage to find out about this bubbling technology, so science is suppressed, and knowledge is suppressed, and much, much more happens. But all of that happens before the book even begins, and then the story follows, you know, just in the world that is set up by that. It uses the rules, and it uses the tools, and it, you know, the original invention is silly. It's, you know, it's stupid. You can't even understand it. It's never fully explained. But the story and the adventure and the intrigue and everything else was a logical outgrowth from it. And then we turn to Exhibit B, Redneck Thunder, and they also have this bubbling technology. But, you know, it's not there for anything, really. It's like, okay, we need to get a bunch of train cars into Mars in 3 days. You know, it's obviously impossible to do that with any current technology. So John Varley just grabs out of his ass this new invention. And again, it's like, how does it impact the world? Well, we don't care. All we need it to be all we need is it's suitable to be slung under some homemade spaceship and take them into space. And another question is, like, wait a second, this is a free energy machine. You know, surely the best thing in the world would just be to share it with the world and solve every energy problem known to mankind, right? But then it's like, no, we don't care about that. We just want it as a rocket engine. And then there's more questions like, what if the inventor of this technology dies on the way to Mars? You know, it's set up as some dangerous journey, but what if he dies on the way to Mars and the technology is lost forever? It's like, doesn't matter. We just need it as a rocket. And there's characters in the book who obviously must understand the second law of thermodynamics. And, you know, the invention itself is more important than the building of the spaceship. But no, they don't care about that. They just want to be the first humans to go to Mars, or the first humans to have sex on Mars, which seems to be the most important thing that happens at the end of the book there. And it's like, again, this question is like, okay, they need to get to Mars. They want Americans to be the first on Mars. So why don't they just give the technology to NASA? And NASA will put it on the back of a like an existing rocket, you know, there's light, and they just get to Mars first. But it's like, no, they don't want Americans to be the first on Mars. The author really just wants our famous five characters to be there first. And, you know, just question after question just comes in. It's like, what the hell's going on here? And it's like the characters, when they come back or on the way to Mars, they set up all these sponsorship deals to get really rich. And I'm just thinking, wait a second, they have a machine here that's broken the second law of thermodynamics. It's like, money no longer has any meaning in the world when the second law of thermodynamics is broken. You know, there's just no, money no longer has any value when there's free energy. And it's like John Val has just completely ignored this question. It's just stupid. It's like everything that I hate about bad science fiction wrapped up in a single example. The impact of technology on the world is explored briefly in the epilogue. It's just called 10 Years Later, and we get like three pages tacked on to the end of the book. But it's like just shallow and so overly optimistic. It's just, it almost made me angry reading the book about how pointless it all was. And like I say, plausible, no. Again, I don't care about like impossible situations or impossible, I don't care about impossible technology as long as it's logical. You know, the outgrowth of the story, the science fiction that comes from that technological invention is logical. But yeah, certainly not plausible at all. Actually, talking of the famous five, there's another children's book that this really brought to mind all the time I was reading it. I was maybe like 6 or 7 years old when I read this book. And it's a picture book, you know, not a lot of text in there, but it's called Bored, Nothing to Do. Or it, I can't remember, that's the first line in the book. Two young boys, two brothers sitting there, and they look, turn to each other, it's like, bored, nothing to do. And so they say, hey, let's build an aeroplane. And they do. They build an aeroplane. They're like 2 10-year-old kids, and they build an aeroplane. And I remember really, really liking that book. Of course, at the time, even back when I was 6 or 7 years old, I realized it was completely implausible. But, you know, once you have the idea, okay, it's possible for 10-year-olds to build an aeroplane, then you can just get on with it and really enjoy the story. And, you know, equally implausible, but actually more enjoyable than Redneck Thunder. At least you get some fun artwork to read. So that'd be my advice, is track down that book, read it instead. It'll take you 10 minutes, and that means you don't actually have to read Redneck Thunder at all. So that's it, really. I'll wrap this book up in one word, which is vapid. Actually, two words. Vapid and insipid. Three words. Vapid, insipid, and stupid. No, four words. No, I'm not going to go on. So yeah, my rating for this book is 1.5 stars out of 5, because I did complete it. I think if I don't complete a book, it automatically has to get about 1 stars, but I did actually get through this. But maybe it's just because I heard it recommended to me as a good book, and I read it because of that. And also because I got the book for free. Well, it's not for free, it costs €1.50, so it's near enough for free, and I knew I had a long flight to go on. So only read this book if you're like a fan of John Varley, and you've read all of his other books and you want to read this one. Or maybe if you just like vapid, insipid, stupid books, you could read it. Or maybe, again, looking on the quote on the back, if you're a reviewer from Publishers Weekly, maybe you'd enjoy this book as well. See, some of these other quotes here as well on the back are quite stupid. Fast-paced, engaging characters. You can't call a book fast-paced when it takes, you know, over half of the book to get to the main point in the story, which is set at the beginning of the book. It's a page turner, but only because I just couldn't believe it was taking so long, and I just wanted to get on with the story. That's the only reason it was a page turner. Okay, check this out. That was a quote from Rocky Mountain News. Here's one by Tom Clancy. John Varley is the best writer in America. Seriously, the best writer in America. Check out this one on the front of the book. It goes, realistic. One of the science fiction's most important writers, a realistic and funny novel, The Washington Post. The thing is with these quotes, all of the quotes about how this book is so good seems to be from non-science fiction sources. Like, there's not a science fiction author who recommends this book, and there's not a science fiction magazine that seems to recommend this book. It's all like praise for John Varley. So all of the praise for John Varley from these science fiction sources and not through this book. So it actually makes me want to read other John Varley books to see if I can see him in a bit more positive light. In fact, one of the quotes here in the first book actually said, you know, Red Thunder is unlike anything John Varley has previously written. And that's by Science Fiction Weekly. And again, it's sort of like, it's a long review, but it doesn't actually say it's a good book. It just says, you know, it pays tribute to Robert Heinlein and Carl Hazen. So yeah, I'm not even sure if it's meant to be a recommendation there from Science Fiction Weekly. I really do not recommend this book. 1.5 stars out of 5. Anyway, I've gone on too long about a book that I really dislike. Again, I can't find anything in this book that I want to recommend to you. Unlike last week's book, which I gave 5 stars because I didn't think there was anything in the book which I disliked in any way at all. The next book that I'm reading, actually started last night, I'm about 5 chapters into it, is called Down the Bright Way by Robert Reed. And I've thought, actually, I read on the Wikipedia page for Marrow that this was the follow-up book. It's not actually a follow-up book, it's not a sequel at all. It just happens to be written by the same author. I guess Wikipedia is full of shit, like everybody says. The next book I'll read after that is Snow Crash by Neil Stephenson, and then after that, well, I'll see what I get up to. So, if you've enjoyed this review, if you disagree with my take on this at all, just email me, luke@juggler.net. I like getting feedback from everyone here. If you have any more book suggestions, email me too, or add them to the wiki page on the sfbrp.com. And also on the wiki page, I haven't actually said this before, but there's lots more information there as well. You can find out the ratings of all the books so far, so if you can't remember if I gave it a book a good rating or a bad rating, you can find it there. Or if you just want to see some recommendations of books that you think I think are good, just check out the ratings there, and each page has got links to the Wikipedia page and the amazon.com page and all of the reviews like that too, and suggestions and corrections and stuff. I put all on the individual pages there. And what I'm going to do is actually start going back through old reviews and start getting the text of some of these reviews that I've made, because I found some good software that transcribes them. So I think I'm going to do that as well, sort of like get the basic text of what I've said on these reviews and start adding them to the wiki, not the Wikipedia, or to the wiki at sfbrp.com. So anyway, thanks for listening and catch you later.